Hello, and welcome to Paranormal or What podcast with me, your host, Michaela Ford. Hello, paranormal peeps. How are you this week? Have you been doing anything spooky? I've had quite an unspooky week this week, I have to say. In fact, I've just come back from helping out at the school disco, and I'm feeling a little hoarse. yeah, I think there's only so much Taylor Swift anyone can take. So I'm back to being spooky now. And we've got a really, really good show for you tonight. I have been interviewing the beautiful and very funny historian, Penny Griffiths Morgan. You might have seen her on Help My House is Haunted and Celebrity Help My House is Haunted. And if you've been to any Parameets or Paracons this year, you might well have seen her there because she's doing the circuits. And she's a very busy lady, so I was very lucky to have a good chat with her. And this is what you're going to be listening to now. So settle down in your favourite chair with a tot of something hot and spicy. Get your blanket and get ready for some fascinating conversation about the paranormal with Penny Griffiths Morgan. Take it away, Penny. Let's say hello to Penny Griffiths Morgan. Hello, Penny.
Hello, Michael with an A. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah.
Perhaps we need to explain the Michael with an A bit.
Go on then. Go on.
No, you it was your thing. You came up with it. You came up with it with Dave Schrader, I think it was, at last year's Festival of the Unexplained.
I know.
Or was it Daryl you came up with it to? I can't, it was either Dave or Daryl.
No, I think it was Dave. He was being very dry as usual, and I over-explain myself. I always explain that I come from Halifax, which is in West Yorkshire, which my husband thinks is hilarious. And when people want to spell my name, I say it's Michael with an A, and people usually just look at me like I'm mad. And then Dave Schrader just kept going. So Michael with an A.
It stuck with all of us. Michael with an A. Yeah.
It does help, though. It has helped many people, especially at post office counters and banks and things like that. So,
I can't believe you need to tell people where Halifax is, or Halifax, I should say, is.
I do. People look at me really confused and go, I thought that was a bank. Well, no, actually, it's a building society and it is a town.
That's what I would have said. Yeah. If someone said it's a bank, no, I would have said, well, actually, yeah.
Get very protective about your hometown, don't you? which brings me on to, actually, it's quite a nice segue. Well done, me. I wanted to just mention the fact that you're originally from Essex.
I am.
And then you had a period where you moved away to Norfolk.
My parents tore me. They tore me from the bosom of Essex at 3 years old to make me live in Norfolk for 20 years.
It's tragic. So I thought over that time you would have got more of an affiliation with Norfolk, but you were sucked back to Essex.
No. The weird thing about the Norfolk I grew up in from the sort of late 70s, 80s, early 90s was it was very, you had to be Norfolk born and bred to be accepted. And I remember, it's not so much like that now because there's more people, I suppose, for want of a better term, immigrants.
Yeah, you're not from round here.
Exactly. It's a lot more. But at the time, if you weren't born and bred or second or third generation, didn't count. And I was always an outsider because they didn't talk like that. My parents didn't talk like that. So I always felt like an outsider. I was always treated like an outsider growing up. And so, yeah, It doesn't it when I go back to see my parents still live there in the same house, and yes, it does feel a bit like going home, going
Yeah.
back to visit them. But no, I've never felt Norfolk. It's a fascinating place, and there's some lovely people who come from there and who live there and everything else, but it was never it I never felt it welcomed me, put it that way.
Yeah, you didn't feel it inside.
That's correct,
So
yeah.
when you moved back to Essex, did it have to be Essex? Was that because your parents were there, or was it just that you felt a pull to go back?
I'm not really sure thing. I'm not really sure why I chose Essex. I think it was that I'd always wanted to come back because I always felt I was from Essex. And I did know a few people who still lived in Essex. And I was just applying for a job around the area, and I got a job that was based in Chelmsford. So it just all sort of fitted in into place, really.
Yeah.
I very nearly, when I was about 20, very nearly moved up to Sheffield with the company I used to work for Norwich Union, and it's when they were moving up to
Oh.
Sheffield, and I was that close to going, but my then boyfriend was like, no, my band I play with is in Norfolk, my family's in Norfolk. So we didn't go. So I very nearly moved up north in my early 20s, but I liked Essex because I think I've always liked Essex. I think it's one of those places that gets an unfair reputation, if I'm
Yeah.
completely honest. And I'm not really sure why it was Essex I moved back to. I just knew I had to leave Norfolk. And I think Essex sort of called me because of the fact I'm from Essex
Yeah.
originally, and I did have family, sort of albeit quite distant family still there. And I say I did have a couple of friends who still lived there, and everything just fit into place really.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I felt the same about Halifax. I had to escape. But that's a whole different story. Now,
Well, the
Matt.
thing with Norwich, right? The Norwich is, I say, fascinating place, absolutely fascinating. The history there is amazing. It's very small. It's the only real big city in what, a 40-mile radius in the
Yeah.
whole of East Anglia. So you can never escape people. And it was actually when my, and this isn't a sympathy vote, the story I'm going to tell you, but it was shortly after my sister had died, and it was in all the newspapers and stuff because nobody knew what it was. And I overheard two older women discussing my sister and saying some quite horrible things about what they thought she'd died of. I was just about to meet my mum for coffee, and it was the first time I'd persuaded my mum to leave the house since my sister had died. And that was one of the things that made me sort of go, I can't stay here anymore. There's times when you just want to be anonymous, you just want to wander around a place and not know anyone. I could not go into Norwich in my sort of early 20s and not see someone I knew.
Yeah.
And that was when I started to get to a, I feel quite claustrophobic.
Yeah.
And then one thing led to another, and I ended up leaving. I broke up with the then boyfriend and thought I want a new start. And everything fitted into place. And I've been here
Yeah.
now 26 years.
Well, I think some things do happen for a reason, though. And I think sometimes it feels like, I don't know, this sounds a bit woo-woo, but like the universe kind of helps you to go where you need to go to.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I
definitely.
believe that. I could say everything just fitted into place. Whether, yeah, we I probably won't be here in 20 years' time because husband and I both want to move back up to North Yorkshire.
Oh, really?
We won't move south. Further south, we'll move north.
Whereabouts, Harrogate sort of way,
I
or
don't know yet. I don't know. We haven't decided exactly where. I mean, for the 20 years we've been together, I've been taking him up to North Yorkshire to visit, and West Yorkshire for that matter, the borders, to
yeah.
visit different parts. So that we haven't decided yet whether we like the moors side or the dales. I love York. York is one of my favourite
Yeah.
places in the world, but I don't know yet. We haven't decided. We might even go even further north, almost to the sort of Durham type Teesside
Yeah.
borders. We don't know yet. We don't know. We just know we want to move up north once the kids are sort of settled and independent, and
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't
So,
that funny? Because we've made similar plans, but we're going the opposite way. We want to go to
no.
Cornwall.
Yeah, no, you see, I've always had, I mean, my dad's a Yorkshireman, and even though I've never lived there, I've always had an affinity with the place. I just relax the minute I see the signs that I'm in North Yorkshire, my blood pressure just drops. And my husband, he's exactly the same. And he'd never been until I took him up there 19 years ago. He'd never been. His family was all like, you either went to Spain on holiday, or you went to like Skegness or Yarmouth or Clacton. And we'd got a dog, and the deal was we'd have a week abroad and then a week in the UK where the dog would come with us. And so for the first one, we had a self-catering cottage just outside of Bridlington. And
Oh, I used to go there all the time.
yeah, and it was really funny because obviously he's Essex born and bred, London, Essex as well. So you don't talk to strangers. Oh, no, you don't talk to strangers at all. And we were in a queue. We had the dog with us. And this lady starts chatting to my husband, and he's like sort of looking really quizzical. And he turns around to me, watch it, and he goes, "Am I supposed to talk back?" And I'm like,
No.
"Oh no." And she just burst out laughing. She went, "He's never been up north, has he?" And I went, "No, I am so sorry." And she goes, "Yes, up here we talk to each other. It's fine. It's not London. You can't stop him now. He literally, he'll talk to everyone now when he's up there. And he's a different person to what he is when he's down
Oh,
south."
yeah.
So it's really nice to sort of see that, and to see him sort of just change. Somebody who's never been up there, and members of his family have never been up north, and they're like, "Oh, I don't know what the big deal is." And it's like, go up there and you will experience it, because Yorkshire does have something magical about it, in my opinion.
It does. There are before I start ranting on about all the things I don't like about it, there are lots of nice things about it, and it can be friendly until it's not, if you know what I mean.
But like anywhere,
Yeah.
like anywhere. I think the thing about Yorkshire that I love is the amount of open space.
Yeah.
Living in parts of Essex does, but nothing like you get up there.
Yeah.
And seeing the difference between the moors and the dales, and they are very, very different.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, people, I can imagine that, a bit like Norfolk, people can be unfriendly, but yeah, I just find it's like, anyway, nowhere is perfect.
Yeah.
Nowhere is perfect, but for us, it's somewhere that we can see ourselves settling at some point when the
Oh.
kids have finished school.
Oh, it's really nice. I'll tell my mum and dad they'll be pleased. I can't get them to move down here. Like, you'll take me out of Yorkshire in a box. Like, come on, you're nearly 80 now. You need to be near me.
No, they don't.
No,
No,
I'm
they
not
don't. No, they don't.
coming down there. No. No.
Were they in Halifax? They Halifax
Yeah,
way.
yeah.
Yeah.
All my friends
Well, saying that, I mean, I remember my dad's mum. I mean, she moved to Harlow, gosh, in the early 60s when Harlow was a new town,
are here.
and from Middlesbrough, when Middlesbrough was Yorkshire and a bit nicer
God.
than it is now. That's where my dad's from. But it was. Back then it was Yorkshire before it became Cleveland, and then it was
Yeah.
Yorkshire. And she moved down to Harlow. Then she left. Where did she go from there? She sold her house in Harlow, gosh, early 80s, I think. And she decided she wanted to be closer to my dad, of her three sons, and so moved to Norfolk. She lasted 3 years before she went back up north, and she went to
Oh my
Redcar.
goodness.
And
Yeah.
she lived there for the rest of her life, happy as, because she was from Mask and Loftus and all around there originally, and all her sisters were there. And yeah, so I think, yeah, she wasn't, she loved being down south to be around her granddaughters and her son and
Yeah.
son, daughter-in-law, but she ended up going back north even after not having lived there for 30 years. She got the
Yeah.
pull back up there. So I think it is quite a powerful thing.
I think it is, yeah, because I know my parents, they come down for, well, they used to, they stopped coming
now, so I have to go up there because it's a bit tricky. But after 3 or 4 days, they start fidgeting. I'm looking at their watches. Is it? Do you think we should be setting off soon? They're like, well, I just got here. Stop it.
Yeah, but I feel like that when I go to Norfolk. I want to get back to
Yeah.
Essex because so I kind of get it. I do kind of get it. But
These
anyway.
places just pull you, don't they? So, how did you start on your journey to being a historian? Is that what you always wanted to do, or did you fall into
No.
it, or what happened?
Oh dear. So as a kid, I didn't really have any interest in history. My parents, and now I'm a parent, I kind of understand why they did it. They always had English Heritage and National Trust memberships. So every holiday we went on in our caravan to either Dorset, Cornwall, or we went to Whitby 1 year, the holiday that I arranged, we would spend a good 3/4 of it in either National Trusts or English Heritage properties. Having kids now, I understand the logic. At the time, I was like, God, this is so boring. I want to go to Spain like my friends do. But it did sort of start to give me an appreciation of what this country has. And then it was when I started doing history at secondary school. I really clicked with my history teacher, a guy by the name of Phil Hancock. And he was quite eccentric. He wasn't very old, actually. I now know he was only in his early 40s. But obviously, when you're 12, that's really old and boring and folk. But he was so energetic and so happy to help when you had queries. And quite frequently, I would stay behind if, like, class was going into a lunch break, or I'd sit and chat to him about something we'd just been doing and like debating bits and questioning bits and everything. And I started to get into it. And then when I took my GCSEs, and then I took history A level. And he told my mum, it's the worst thing Penny could do. She's going to fail it. She is going to hate every single second of it. And he was spot on. I did
Oh
fail it.
no.
I did hate every single second of it. It was the most dull and boring. It was just, yeah, it was. But what he'd said is that if she got through it and got to degree level, she'd do really well. But I kind of lost my love for it after that. It kind of left such a bitter taste in my mouth, how dull it was and how I didn't think the teachers. Actually, it's funny. Actually, quite a lot of people in my class who needed history A level to go to college, I didn't go to college, failed. Because,
Was it the teacher that did
yeah, it
the
was
A
just boring.
level?
And he, pardon?
Sorry, I was going to say, was it the teacher? Because it's so
No,
important what teacher you have.
it was a bit of both, I think. I mean, we did European and English history from about 1780, so just before the French Revolution. And it was meant to take us all the way up to World War II. Now, it was late, but it, like English history, it was all the politics and everything. It wasn't anything that I would say, there was no social history in it. And I was quite looking forward to getting to the World War I bit to sort of learn the politics behind what we didn't even make it that far. So the bit that I really wanted to do, the sort of, well, the 20th century stuff, so World War One, the suffrage movement, all of that, what led up to World War Two, we never got to study that. So the things that would interest me, I mean, well, we spent God knows how long just talking about Disraeli and Gladstone and the arguments they would have and stuff. And but it wasn't even done in a the way when I explain history, I will try and make it applicable to what people are seeing now. So it might be, I don't know, Angela Rayner attacking Rishi Sunak, that kind of thing. I would have brought that, no, nothing like that. And so part of it, I think, was the teachers were just teaching rather than educating, if that, or lecturing rather than educating, if that makes sense. But
And no
also,
storytelling.
no, none at all. And I'll be honest, sometimes I fell asleep in class. So my history teacher was right, but so I mean, I'd always like airplanes and things like that. I'd always interested. I always used to go to air shows. Loved aviation, but it probably wasn't until well into my late 20s I started thinking, actually, this is quite interesting. I can do what I want now. I can read up on the stuff that interests me. as opposed to, and ironically, some of the stuff I read up on now, I probably did cover during my history A level, but I cover it in a different way now because it's not, it's kind of a side quest to something I'm doing as opposed to the main quest. But no, I never, I still struggle to class myself as a historian because it's not my full-time job, even though I would love it to be. It's one of those that I take what I can. And I don't have any sort of if I could do it for a living, I would, but I can't. So as it stands at the moment, so if I can get one person who sort of thought history was boring because they had a bad experience at school to actually go, blimey, this is quite cool, I'm happy. That's really why I do what I do now, is that, and when people come back, and if I've talked about something, they come back with questions, I know they're taking an interest, I'm happy. So yeah, no, I never envisaged being a historian at all. It's quite, I find it quite ironic that that's what I'm becoming known as, and I'm pretty sure my teacher Phil Hancock, who actually passed away at 43 from a heart attack whilst playing rugby, it absolutely devastated me. I was about 20, 21 when it happened. I think he's probably sitting up wherever he is, killing himself laughing that this is what I am doing now, knowing how badly I flunked my history A level.
You can never tell which way people are going to go. I have a permanent sense of regret, and I'm quite annoyed actually. I had the history teacher from hell. She was an evil little witch. I won't say her name, but it's emblazoned on my memory. And she put me off history. I didn't even choose it because I'm a bit older than you, and I did O
Are you?
levels.
I don't think you
Yes,
are you? I was the
I did
second
O
year.
levels.
Oh, I was second year of GCSEs.
You're the same age as my husband, but
Right.
he's my toy boy.
Hey, mine's 7 years younger than me, so there you go.
Yay! There we go. He's Tom's 6 years younger than me, but. Yeah, so I didn't even choose history as one of my options because she was such a bitch. And we used to have these blackboards that were kind of roller blackboards. They were
I
kind of
remember them,
black plastic stuff, and they'd kind of trundle around. And you'd walk into the class, and she would have literally written in white chalk all over both sides of the board. And she would go, right, you've got 20 minutes to copy down that side, then I'm moving it, and I don't care who's finished. And that was history. That was it. There was no discussion. There was nothing. It was just a list of facts and figures and dates.
But that's what my A level was like, albeit that the teachers just talked at us constantly. And yeah, I probably could have tried harder than I did. I kind of got to the stage where I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. But there was nothing in it that sort of, I know when you get to A level, you have to be a bit more independent with your work because it's getting you ready for degree level. But it went from, I'm not being spoon-fed for my GCSEs, but getting help to, no, you have to work this out for yourself. Why is my essay not good enough? Well, your vocabulary's not strong enough. Well, what do you want me to do? Because I read on a daily basis. I don't, I watch the news, I watch things like that. Well, you just got to improve your vocabulary. Yes, but how? Well, you have to work that one out for yourself. And that's what it was like. And I think there was too much going, it was too much. It was like going from having your hand held to do your O levels to you're on your own now.
Push you out of the
And
door, kind of. It's
sorry.
kind of pushing you out of the door. Go on, fend for yourself.
And whereas I understand with degree, you do an awful lot of the work for yourself. You have to work out what routes to research and everything. You still get reading lists. You still get that kind of thing. But no, I remember my mum came home from parents' evening and she said, your essays aren't, they're too GCSE-ish for A level. And I'm like, well, what am I supposed to do? Tell me what to do and I'll try and
Do
do
it.
it. And they never told me. They just said, oh, you need to work it out. And I was like, give me an example sample essay then. Give me, something like that. But I didn't get that. So,
It is easier now, I think, with the internet and everything, because you can get examples from everywhere. My eldest son's in the first year of A levels, and he's doing classical civilizations, which she's finding quite hard, to be honest. My youngest is doing GCSEs, and he's going to do history A level next year because he's obsessed with history. So I hope he enjoys it.
Well, my eldest is just about to take his options, and he can't do both humanities. He can only do geography or history because of the sort of set he's in.
Yeah.
And he came up to me recently, went, "Mum, please don't be angry with me, but I'm dropping history." And I'm like, "You're dead to me, mate. I don't want to know you anymore." But he prefers geography. So
Fair enough.
the strange thing is, his history teacher said he's actually really good at history, but he prefers geography. So
Yeah.
I'm not going to force him into doing subjects that I would like him to do. I want him to do what he wants to do. Partly because I think if you're forced into doing subjects as a teenager, you tend to resent that and you're not
Yeah.
gonna. But also, if he doesn't do the work, he can't use the excuse of me that I made him do it. It's like, it's your choice. The thing there's only I did convince him to do Spanish because he's quite good at it, and even though he doesn't realize it, it's science and maths he's unhappy about having to do, but it's like, you've got to do them, mate, whether you like it or not. So yeah, whereas my younger son, he apparently is very good at science and history at primary school, so one of each.
Yeah, there you go. Swings and roundabouts, isn't it? So I was wondering now, you have managed to do this really interesting mix of history and the paranormal. Can you tell me what got you into the paranormal?
I've always, ever since I was knee-high to a grasshopper, thought there was something out there that we didn't understand. I used to have things happen to me, things that I couldn't explain. Even though my parents' house in Norfolk is only like a 1960s house, I'd see stuff. I think my dad was coming home from work when he was actually away for like 3 or 4 months. I thought I saw someone walking through the door. So I always believed there was something going on. When I sort of hit my early 20s, when I moved back to Essex, I decided that no, I was going to be a sensible career woman. I was going to forget all about that weird stuff and just be quasi normal. That probably lasted until I was in my early 30s, and I was just like, why have I ignored all this? It's too cool, and started getting back into it again. But it was when I would have been, it was about 10, 12 years ago, 10 years ago. I was watching, it was when my youngest was a baby. And anyone who's had children knows the pain, especially women. I hate to say this, it's nearly always the women, the pain of night feeds.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So I think husband was getting up very early for work because he's a builder. Youngest was awake, so I'd taken him downstairs and he would take ages to feed. So I'd put the television on so I could watch something while he's just sat there. And there was this series of these, there was these really lovely American blokes talking in an accent that I couldn't understand, and they were doing paranormal investigating. Once my ear got used to the accent, it was Tennessean. It was the Tennessee Wraith Chasers in Ghost
Oh,
Asylum.
wow.
And once I understood the accent, there was like two or three episodes on each night. They were catching up with the series. So I recorded them. So I always had something to watch when I was doing the night feeds, because he did used to take a good hour to feed. And it made me sort of start thinking, God, you get to do ghost hunting with like gadgets and things. This is so cool. And I sort of talked to my husband. He goes, oh, why don't you try and find a group to join? You've always had an interest in it. And it kind of went from there. And it was because I have a natural ability to hyper focus on research on things. I was looking up stuff for people and I was like, well, actually, this isn't true. What you're telling me, the history of this place, that isn't true. That's made up. And it's kind of Chinese whispers from what maybe a psychic has picked up, and people, instead of trying to work out whether the psychic got the wrong images or whatever, had just gone with it and said, this is the history of the place. And I'd be like, well, not according to the census records, not according to the newspapers, not according to land registry, not according. And it kind of went from there. And then somebody called Richard Clements, who used to have a Paris podcast group called Parasearch. And he said, would you like a podcast? Because you're very good on camera, because I used to do Facebook Lives for them. And he said, come up with a podcast idea. It's yours. And I thought, well, one of my biggest bugbears is when history gets made up to fit a place's either to fit a place's hauntings or to try and promote its hauntings by making out, you know, that the place was a morgue and 15 children were murdered there and all of that stuff. And so that's how I came up with Haunted Histories. And it kind of has gone from there, really.
So tell us about Haunted Histories, because that's the name of your podcast, isn't it?
It's kind of my brand, my podcast. It started off as my podcast. It's now kind of the brand, if you like. I am Penny from Haunted Histories. So yeah, it started, I mean, it's changed a lot over the last 8, 9 years, how the podcast come about. But yeah, it's basically a podcast where I will interview someone. Normally they're the paranormal. It started off that they were the paranormal person. I came in as the historian, maybe coming up with history that matched stuff that they'd had experience, or telling them a history of their favorite location that they didn't know. And it kind of went from there. In the last few years, I've got to know more actual historians, like proper historians. And so they've started coming on the show. So they'll do the history bit and I do the paranormal sort of bit. And it's starting to, because my whole goal with Haunted Histories and what I do in general is so that people who do the paranormal work don't think historians are boring, fuddy-duddy, like tweed jacket, leather elbow patches. With historians actually can help the paranormal field, and for historians not to think everyone in the paranormal field is completely bonkers and woo-woo and thinks even like it's a ghost trying to communicate with you, you know. And that was me knocking the table in case anyone thought that was a ghost trying to
Oh,
communicate with you.
snap.
Sorry. Although saying that, I've got a bookshelf behind me. My house does have a spirit in it. She owned the house before we moved in here. She'd been here since 1971 and she died in the house. One of my books flew off the bookcase while I was sitting here earlier. And it was a book on witchcraft, which I thought was quite amusing. Because I was like, kids, did you move that book? And my son's like, no, I haven't touched it. And it was in the bookshelf and it just fell to the floor. And this is my like space and that's my bookshelf. So nobody else touches it. But anyway. So yeah, and it was really to sort of bring the two sides together and to make them realize, and you know, since then, since getting to know quite a lot of, I think, very respected historians, they will actually ask me questions about how would you look at this and what would you deal with for this and what would happen with this, and maybe they're getting a sort of, well, actually there is validity in some of the stuff that you find out. And then also in the paranormal field, more and more people seem to be embracing the idea of using history on investigations. So I'm not saying I'm the only one that does that. There's some amazing people out there doing Mike Covell, Neil Storey, Kate Sherrill, all those kind of people all do this. But that was my reason for marrying the two subjects.
Oh, I mean, I don't really know how you can do a paranormal investigation without history. Because they are so connected. It's just, I mean, everywhere that I've investigated, the first thing I do is go and research the place and see what I can find out about it. Because not because I want to try and tie it in with ghosts or anything, but just because I want to know what it is, what makes it tick, what's happened there.
I
And
think
I
that
think it's
depends
very
on the, some
important.
people, yeah, some people, I mean, I understand that mediums don't want to know any of the history when they go into a place. And I have been accused of almost making stuff up because I know the history. I've made up stuff that fits in with the history. But as I've said, I've done so much of this. It's very hard for me to go into a place completely cold because I could go to a castle and I could look at it and tell you roughly when it was built just by how it's, you know, what the
The
design.
architecture,
I can tell you which area was the kitchen because I can see what the brickwork of the old fireplace or the well, or so it's very hard for me not to do that. When it comes to airfields, I know a lot of the airfields in the UK. So but I don't always do a deep dive on a place before I go in. I might do a few bits because I might use the history as a trigger. So for example, if I knew that the airbase I was going to was predominantly American in World War II and not British, I'm not going to be playing British 1940s music there. I'm going to be playing Glenn Miller and that kind of thing as a trigger. So that's the kind of thing I might look into. Or if I knew that it was a fighter base as opposed to a bomber base, I might go in there with sounds of fighter aircraft as opposed to bombers, that kind of thing. But I'm not going to look into every single crash that happened, every single crew that didn't come home.
Then trying to fit them together. So what got you into aviation then?
Always been into it. My dad's well, he's an amateur pilot. I can't remember why he didn't get into the RAF at 18. There was a reason. But he's always flown. He's flown gliders since I was before I was born. So I was always around aeroplanes. My uncle was an RAF pilot for his entire life. And I was always a tom I'm a tomboy. I'm not a girly girl. So I'm much more into engines than pink. And I just find flying fast. I love going up. I love the sound of aeroplanes, helicopter. I just find it fascinating. And I love engines, things with engines in. I do enjoy it.
So are you going to learn how to fly, or can you already fly?
No, it's I haven't got a spare £10,000 these days at the moment to learn. My dad jokes that when he's gone, if I don't use some of my inheritance to get my license, he will come back and haunt me.
Good
And
for
then,
him.
realizes I'm the wrong person to say that to because it's not going to bother me. So he's actually changed that. He said, if you don't use it, I won't come back and haunt you. So they, you know, so I will one day when I've got, but having sort of two school age kids, money isn't.
Time and money, two very precious things.
So no, it's something I will do. I mean, anyone says to me, do you want to come up? Do you want to go for a fly? If they know me, they tend to just hand me the controls because I've been doing it for a long time. I'm not allowed to do take. I know I have done that. I have landed an aeroplane before, thinking about it, but more than once. But you know, I'm not supposed to, I'm not, I don't do takeoffs because they're the dangerous bits. But flying, once you're up in the air, flying around is really easy, to be honest.
Just point it in that direction, should be
Literally,
not knowing
literally.
anything about
It
it.
literally is. You've just got to keep the aircraft relatively balanced and try not to stall it, basically. But no, takeoff and landings are the technical bit, in general flying, in my experience. But no, I've just always loved airplanes. I find them fascinating. And I was all even before I got into have a love of history, I found the aviation side of World War II interesting. But that's because the airbase, the base that my father has flown from since I was 3 years old, was an American airbase in World War II. And Jimmy Stewart, the actor, was based there. So it's always been something that I found interesting. And the village that I grew up in, there's a big hall there that was, I was growing up there, Formula One Lotus was based there and had been since the 60s. In World War II, it was the headquarters for the Second Air Division, which was where Jimmy Stewart worked for. It was where the main, I think it was about 8 or 9 airfields in Norfolk belonged to as part of the 98th American Air Force. So there's always been that kind of link. But I love the sound of aeroplanes, all aeroplanes. And I find it fascinating watching them.
I've got one. I've got an aviation museum near me, and it used to be a small sort of place. I don't know if it was American or not. It's Tangmere.
Tangmere, I'm pretty sure Tangmere was ink British, because I'm looking it up actually, because that's annoying me now. Most of the American one, well, the bombers, it could have been.
Because it was only small, but they've got quite a lot of aeroplanes in there that you can go and visit now. It's
RAF Tangmere.
right
No,
next to
I know.
Goodwood.
Yeah, I know. It was RAF Fighter Command. I thought it was. RAF Fighter Command. It was actually founded in 1917. The Royal Flying Corps worked from there as well during World War One. But yeah, it was RAF fighters. What was based there? Spitfires. So yeah, a lot of the American bomber bases were in East Anglia, so Norfolk and Suffolk, and sort of slightly up the Wash. Because they would go straight over the North Sea
Yeah, I
into
presume
Europe.
they need a bigger amount of space to take off as well, do they?
Depends on the aircraft. You'd be surprised actually how short a runway some of them could go up from. And also, it depended on what bomb load they were carrying, because if they overloaded the bomb loads, it was very hard for the pilot to get the aircraft to pull up before the end of the runway, which is there were quite a few crashes at, well, all bomber bases in British and all allies, and probably German as well, to be quite honest, when they overload with bombs and there's too much weight for the aircraft to get enough lift to clear normally the trees at the end of the runway. But you'd be surprised on the runways didn't they it was more a case of the fighters could take off on grass runways quite easily because of the weight, whereas the bombers needed reinforced runways because of the weight.
Because of the weight of it. And did all bombers, or was it just a few of them, have that horrible little capsule where the poor bloke had to sit in the
The
bottom?
ball turret.
Yeah. Oh my God, what a terrifying job.
Yeah, that would have that well, yeah. Most oh gosh, I don't know if they all the big ones. It wasn't the small ones, because you've got all different size of bombers. So you had medium range bombers like Mosquitoes and things like that. And then you had the big heavyweight bombers. So you're looking at Halifax, Lancaster, and then America's Liberators, Flying Fortress. I think a lot of them did have the ball turret, but I know for a fact that the Liberators, the B-24s, stopped using the ball turret gunners, partly to decrease the weight so they could carry more bombs, but also I don't think the success of the ball turrets warranted the loss
Of the
of the
poor blokes,
man.
yeah.
But yeah, a lot of the big bombers, I mean, the big bombers were sitting ducks, even though they would have a nose gunner, two waist gunners. So if you can imagine the fuselage
Yeah.
of the aeroplane. So you've got a pilot and co-pilot or engineer sitting in there, depending on what type of aircraft it was. Americans prefer co-pilots. A lot of the British ones had flight engineers.
Yeah.
Then you'd have someone in the nose with a big gun. These are the big bombers I'm talking about, before anyone jumps on me. The big heavyweight, long distance heavyweight bombers. You'd have someone in the nose with a gun. You'd have someone in the tail with a gun. You'd have like a top turret gunner. Sometimes that was the engineer, sometimes it was specific. You'd have the two waist gunners, so in the middle of the fuselage, one either side. But and they would sometimes be successful, but not that often, especially when the Germans started using Messerschmitts with pretty much cannons on board. That they would
Oh, goodness.
they was like shooting fish in a barrel.
Oof.
So no, I wouldn't have wanted to. I To be honest, the ball turret, yeah, that and also the fact that when you took off, that it would retract the turret, ball turret, to take off. But sometimes if they were making a crash landing, the hydraulics are gone, so they couldn't retract it to crash.
There's a film where that happens. I can't think what the film is now. Where they tried to make a crash landing and they couldn't get him to go up, and he
No.
knew
Yeah.
that they were basically going to
You
land
can't, and
on
you can't
him.
get out. You're literally bent. I mean, it surprises me they didn't have height restrictions for ball turret gunners, and they didn't. Because I must admit, I can't remember where I was. It was a museum, and you could try and get into where how the and I'm only 5 foot 2, and even I struggled.
Oh my goodness.
So, but no, even if you're in the tail or the nose, you weren't getting out quickly. Yeah, no, I wouldn't want to. The ball turret one is the one that, and it's. I also think about how the pilot would have felt, knowing full well they're going to crash. That probably the person in the nose ain't going to make it, and the person in the ball turret ain't going to make it if you have to do a crash landing. It was a lot of responsibility.
Gosh. Right, on to a slightly happier subject, hopefully. Now, you have written quite a lot of books. I'm just going to read some out here that I've got. I've got My Haunted History, The Elements of Epping Forest, The Battle for Bosworth Hall, A Haunted Experiment, and Paranormal Playtimes. And then you also did a foreword on Richard Easthepp's The Hanging Pit, The
I
Haunting of
did.
Holman Jail.
Yeah, I was part of the investigation for that one as well.
Fantastic. So your first book, am I right in saying, was 2019?
Was it? I thought it was.
I think.
I don't know. It was My Haunted History.
Yeah.
Sounds about right.
So how did you decide what to write about? When you decide to write a book, how did, out of all the things in the
Oh.
world that you could write about, what how did you decide?
Well, the first book was Richard S. Stepp's Fault. I'd always wanted to write a book. That's something I'd always wanted to be able to do. And he was very much, well, get on with it then. And I was like, I haven't got a clue where to start. And I realized that at the time, the way I did the podcast was I would do a chat with the paranormal, and then I would do just me, almost like a monologue of the history. And I realized I'd written a script for every single one of these locations. And I thought, well, why reinvent the wheel? So I sort of tidied up my script a bit, and then chose places that I'd investigated so I could then do a talk about my experiences of investigating them. And that's why when people have read it, they said, oh, it's very two different. It doesn't, they don't blend properly. I said, well, they're not meant to. The bit that's telling you what I did is meant to be quite chatty and everything, whereas the other bit is meant to be quite technical and what you'd read in an encyclopedia. And so that's how that one came up. And I genuinely thought that would be it. I was going to write one and that was it. But I got the bug. And I think I was just finishing up that one when I got the idea for a haunted experiment. And I got the idea for a haunted experiment. Every single one of my books, there's, I can tell you the thought process behind where the idea came from. So I got my idea for a haunted experiment. I was doing the Daily Mail photo shoot on women in the paranormal, and there was Hazel Ford was there, Joe Jackson, trying to think who else, MJ Dixon, and a few other people. And I was listening to them talking about different experiments that you could do. And I started thinking, well, everyone writes about how to do these experiments. Nobody writes on how the experiments were devised, like who thought of it, what's the history? And it got me thinking, everything's got a history to it. Everything's got a thought process as to how that person came up with it. And so I thought, well, rather than write a book that tells people how to do the experiment, why don't I write a book that says how the experiment was, the history of the experiment, for want of a better term. And then I'm going to go to some locations and try some of these experiments. So, excuse me, so I get to do history of a location, history of the experiment, and then see how
If it
well it
works, yeah.
works. And so that's how that one came up. Paranormal Playtime didn't work out the way originally it was meant to, because I went to visit the British School in Hitchin, which is what the book's based on, in September 2019. And they said, oh, it's going to be our, I think it was our silver anniversary of the museum opening in, would have been 2021. Would you write a book on the place? And this is before Haunted Experiment was even written. So I was getting things lined up. So I started researching for that one. And what happened in March 2020? The whole world shut down. So consequently, I couldn't get to the archives. I couldn't get to do investigations at the school. I couldn't do what we'd planned for me to do for this book, but they still wanted the book. So that one had to be a bit more thinking outside the box to achieve it, which is why a lot of the investigations in there were just me, because they allowed me into the school out of hours to do my own investigations, but I couldn't have loads of people with me. The Bosworth book was one that I had done an interview with Paul and Andy from Haunted Mag on Haunted Histories about Bosworth Hall a few years beforehand. And I thought this would be quite an interesting story, this place. It's got so much going on. So that was on my to do. I've got a long list of books I'm going to write. So plot spoiler here. I've got quite a lot. And every time I get a new idea for another one, it goes on the list to sort of work through. And then I got asked to do the first Festival of the Unexplained, and I thought, well, that might as well write this one next then. So I wrote that one. And then Elements of Epping Forest is all Jane Harris's fault, because it was the first ever episode of Help I did. It was Celebrity Help with Frankie Essex. Was based in Epping Forest, and I'd come with all this research because I didn't know how much they'd need. And it was Jane that said it would be a shame for all this research to go to waste. Why don't you write a book on it? And that's how Elements of Epping Forest
Oh, right.
came
Fantastic.
about. So,
Good old Jane. I
yeah.
love Jane. She's great.
Oh, she's a pain in the backside. She keeps giving me work
Yeah,
to do. So that's how that one came about. So sometimes they come about because I've had an idea about something that I think would work. Some of them, it's someone else has kind of given me the idea and I've made it bigger.
yeah.
I mean, the one I'm writing at the moment that hopefully should be out for the September Festival of the Unexplained, a lot of people have said they wished that my haunted history was more autobiographical, was more about me and things that I've experienced personally and stuff. So that's the one I'm writing at the moment. It's going to be very, very raw me.
Ooh, blood, sweat, and tears while writing.
Oh, so a few bit there. I must admit, a few bits I have had to pull back because it's just too raw, too photo exposed. But yeah, it's talking about some of the experiences I've had and how they've made me who I am. And yeah, that's the current one I'm working
Ooh,
on.
I'll look forward to that then. So have you got a particular process that you do when you're researching for a book, or is it do you have a system? Do you plan it meticulously, or do you just dive in and visit loads of places, or
All of the above. So, I'm not one of those that's got a pin board with loads of like post-it notes or anything like that. I will always have like a new notebook for every book. Every book I write has a notebook.
yeah.
So I can write in things that I've found. Maybe if I'm reading a book that's to do with what I'm researching, I can write some notes in or reference note all of that. To-do list, things that I need to look up, things that maybe if I know that I'm going to go to one of the archives, all the different things that I want to check out in the archive. The only sort of breakdown that I do is I always know roughly how many words I want the book to be.
Yeah.
So I'll have, and this sounds really nerdy, I have an Excel spreadsheet that I write down how many words I want to do, what I think the chapters are going to be about, and
Yeah.
then a goal for a number of words for each one. So I can see I'm working towards it. But other than sort of having say when I let me think of one. So say with Elements of Epping Forest, I knew that one of the chapters was going to be on fiction that's been written about Epping Forest.
Yeah.
So I knew that that was going to be one of my chapters, and then it was like, right, so we want to do what the forest is, where it came from, and then break going from there. And so if there was a lot of stories about haunted buildings in the forest, I would have one of the chapters as being buildings of Epping Forest. And it's about putting the things into the, because what I want is that that people don't feel they have to read the whole book. They can read a
Yeah.
chapter and learn just from eight. So it's like 10 mini books as opposed to a book that if you haven't read chapter two, there's no point reading chapter eight because it
Yeah,
won't make
yeah.
sense. They do refer to each other, but not in a way that you'd be like, where's she talking about again? So that's really sort of how, but no, I'd say my process is just let it flow and see what happens, really. But I
Yeah.
do, the only sort of, I do have my notebooks that I write all my notes in. I do have a word count thing, so I can
Yeah.
see that I'm getting there as
Heading
opposed
in
to
the
like,
right direction,
yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
Oh, fantastic. I'm particularly taking note of all this advice because I'm in the middle of writing a book, not a non-fiction, it's a fiction book, which I'm
Yeah.
really finding very, very hard because you have to have a story and everything. But just the getting started, I've got lots of
That's the hardest
notebooks.
bit. Yeah.
At the moment, I've just got lots of notebooks with stuff in. And the next stage is to go, right, what are we going to do with all this then?
I only ever have one notebook per book. One notebook. If you have too many, it doesn't focus you enough. I've
Yeah.
got a couple of fiction stories I'm sort of working on. And do you know when I found the best way, what times to work out the story and to think of something I've not actually thought of? It's when I'm falling asleep. If I'm falling
Oh.
asleep and I'm thinking of my character and your brain is kind of going on a bit of a tangent, always
Yeah.
have a notepad by your bed because you will think of something. As you're just sort of dozing off, you're saying, that's a good twist, right? And
Yeah,
you'll forget when you wake up. So always have a notebook and just write down what the twist is,
and have it
because then
next to
it'll
your
be,
bed.
yeah.
Yeah.
I do
That's
that
really
too.
good advice. The time when I have most of my ideas, which is a bit difficult, is when I'm swimming, because
Okay.
I only ever swing breaststroke because I'm really rubbish at front crawl. And so I just kind of like an old lady up and down the pool, and I just kind of mull around in my head about bits of the story, and then I'll go, I was trying to remember that when I
You
get
can't
out.
put a notepad next to the pool when you're swimming.
Maybe I could actually. Maybe I
The other
could.
way to remember something is to say it out loud to yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're doing old lady breaststroke, nobody's going to care that you're talking to
No,
yourself.
I do it all the time anyway, so it won't be any
But yeah, see, if
different.
just take a notepad and pen next to the pool.
Yeah,
I
right.
would, I'd do that.
It sounds like a really good idea because it is. It's the only time my mind ever switches off, really. When I'm very lucky that when I go to bed, I literally just
Oh, you
I'm
see, I
straight
don't. I
out.
my mind, or I'll just start drifting, and like I'm half
Yeah.
asleep, half awake. But no, I always have a notepad by the bed, because sometimes I'll be like dozing off, and I'll come up with this brilliant idea, and I'm like, right, I've got to wake up now and write it down. It means I won't go to sleep, but it's a good idea,
Yeah.
and it, I suffer for my art. But yeah, always have a little note, even those like little ones that are like the size, the size of a
The
phone,
tiny
really
ones,
tiny
yeah.
ones. Yeah, have one with you at all times, because you never know. You might see someone walking down the street, and you're thinking, that is the perfect person to play that character that I've been thinking of. So you
Yeah.
want a notepad to be able to write down
Yeah. No,
stuff.
that's a really, really good idea. I like
Thank
that.
you.
I wrote a note and I've completely forgotten what the name of it was. I was reading, so of course, being a very professional podcast host, I've been doing lots of research about you on the internet. She
Yeah, don't
says.
believe all of it. Don't believe all of it.
And I found this website that I was looking at, and I can't. Oh, here we are. Because of course we're human beings and we're not talking in the order of my questions, so I keep having to find the bits that I want to talk about. So you wrote an article on the Haunted Houses website
Oh, yes.
about the Estes method,
Yes.
which obviously, now that you've explained it, seems a bit like what you were talking about. So you talked about the history of the Estes method and where it came from, and having a go at it. So for the listener, can you tell us a little bit about the Estes method and your attempts at doing it?
Remind me where I did it. Does it say where, what location I did it in?
I haven't written that bit down.
Oh, well, I
Sorry.
mentioned it.
Any Estes method will do.
Okay, I talk about it in. It's one of the experiments I talk about in a haunted experiment.
Yeah.
Because I was lucky enough to interview Carl, who was one of the quasi inventors, or one of the
Carl
ones who made.
Pfeiffer, is it?
That's
Yeah.
the one, yeah. Who was one of the ones who kind of brought it. I think it's an experiment that's been done a lot by different people, but they
Yeah.
actually kind of copyrighted it, for want of a better term.
Yeah.
And the reason it's called the Estes method is because they started doing it, I believe it was in the Stanley Hotel, which is in
Yeah.
Estes, Colorado, which is where he got the name Estes
That's
method.
so
And
interesting.
thank you. I'm amazed I can remember this, because I didn't know what you were going to ask me. So the
Oh,
fact that the
sorry.
memory's remembering this, like, cool, blimey, dig in the depths. So the Estes method, it's still one of my favorite ones to do, because what you're basically doing, you will have a spirit box set up, and you will have the receiver, and the receiver will block out all other signals apart from what they can hear through the spirit box. So they'll have a blindfold on, they'll have noise cancelling headphones, all they can hear is what the spirit box is saying. And then you'll have someone asking questions, and they
Yeah.
then call out what the answer is. I when I did I know where I did it. It was Harwich Readout. I took it on another step. So I had two voice recorders going, one that was recording what the box was saying, and then one that was recording the answers I was giving. And then I had someone who was in a different, because we were in where the cells are at Harwich Readout. I had someone up the other end of the corridor, so there was no way I could hear them. Actually, she would say, right, the time is this. This is the question I'm asking, because then we could correlate it with what
What the answer
I
was.
was saying. Yeah. So I do know a few people who do it like that. They'll do it so that they're not in the room with the person who's actually answering, so there's no risk of them hearing what
The
the
question,
questions are.
yeah.
But yeah, it was an interest. I enjoy, I do enjoy doing that one because some of the results I've seen. We did it when I did a public investigation at RAF Tibbenham summer before last. And I got people trying it in one of the hangars, and most people they weren't getting anything. But this one young lad, he was getting stuff coming through, like he'd clicked into something. And the weird thing was, it was his dad asking the questions, and he couldn't hear him because we checked. And the stuff he was coming out with was quite accurate and just constant. So it is, yeah, it's an interesting one to do. But
Yeah,
that's the Estes method.
it is one of my favorite ones. I did it, I've done it a couple of times, but the best one was I did it, have you heard of My Haunted Hotel?
Danny Moss's
Danny
place.
Moss's, yeah. So I did it there, and it was so weird because I don't know if it was just my awareness because, certain things were blocked off, I couldn't see. But I felt a really powerful presence to my right-hand side, and I could have sworn that if I put my hand out, I would have touched somebody, but there was no one there. And I don't know whether it was just my imagination, or it was just fabulous, though.
Yeah, I did it. I've done it at Bosworth Hall as well. And it sounds weird, but I was laid on this double bed. Jane Rowley was doing it as well separately. And we wanted to see if we came up with the same things. Completely opposite. I came out as an obnoxious male, misogynistic pig, basically the stuff I was coming out with. Yet she was crying and upset and not well. And I think there was one point when I suddenly shot up because I sort of obviously was blindfolded, headphones, spirit box going, and I felt someone leaning over me, and I thought it was someone about to play a joke on me, and like, ha, I made you jump. And I shot up and everyone was at the other end of the room. Yeah, I felt someone, like you can feel when someone comes close to your face. So yeah, it's but any kind of sensory deprivation type thing, I think, is it the Gansfield method? Where they have almost like red lights and red glasses, so the person can't see and their vision is completely distorted. It's what can you hear going on? And I think that's Gansfeld, something like that. But all of that, any kind of sensory deprivation. But I find it's the best one to do it with is the it's so you can hear but you can't see. And I did that as I've done that as well at Harwich Readout, and we all blindfolded, and we could hear something scuttering around the floor, and there was no one there, and we could hear
Oh,
someone moving
gosh.
around the floor. It's yeah, it's any kind of sensory deprivation seems to produce, but you have to trust the people you're with, and I don't trust people very easily, so it's a real struggle for me to do anything sensory deprivation. But no, Estes, yeah, it's definitely one that. It's an interesting one to do, and it's a good sort of starter experiment for people, I think, as well.
Yeah, it really is. So, what are your favorite types of equipment then? Do you have favorites, or do you just like using all the stuff?
I probably would say Spirit Box is one of my favorites to use. Even though a lot of people say it's just a broken radio, I've had things happen using a Spirit Box which even electrical engineers can't explain, and radio experts and everything else. Like one that had a signal coming through in Kelvedon Hatch nuclear bunker, which is not only built within a Faraday cage, is well over 150 feet below ground, and has to have the mofo of all antennas to work. And I got voices coming through on it, because Barry Guy wouldn't believe me until somebody said, no, we heard them, we heard the voices. So I think. Yeah, I think a spirit box is one of my favorites, but if I'm honest, I just me. Like what am I picking up on? I don't think. I mean, I love gadgets, I'll be honest. I do love a gadget. But and even with structure, not structure, SLS cameras and things like that, I've had some weird experiences. I just like going in on my own almost and seeing what happens, you know.
Seeing what you feel.
Seeing what you pick up, seeing what you feel, seeing if you can, you know, if you say, can you finish this knock? Like, and you get a knock back going. Things like that to me, you don't need, you just need a torch and your mobile phone. If you want to start off, that really is all you need. Oh, and with me, I always have a notepad so I can, when I have a break, I can write down everything that's happened. So if there's a name come through or something like that, I can look it up. Because
So
I'll
that you
never
can remember
remember
everything.
after 7, 8 hours of sleep deprivation. But no, you only need a torch. Oh, you don't even need a torch really, because most mobile phones have them. But I normally say to people to take a torch, excuse me, torch and your mobile phone. It's got a camera. It's most of them have got voice recorders, so you can do EVPs, and a torch, because the torches are quite good to play with as well. Because if you get one that ghost that's playful and wants to turn the torch on and off,
Then
that's
that's
quite cool when it
it's
happens.
really amazing. It is amazing when that happens. So have you got a favorite place that you've been to that's haunted, or a story that you could tell us?
I have got a soft spot for Keldon Hatch, I will admit, because it's one of my locals. And I do have a soft spot for that place. I used to love Drakelow Tunnels when you were allowed to investigate there. The Leopard Inn was fantastic in Burslem, the one that burnt down. That was amazing, that place. I don't think I have a genuine favourite. I mean, I like an airbase because I've got that military side. I love a fort as well because of the military side. But there's none really. I'm not going to say the ones that I've said I'd never go back to because I thought they were hyped. I won't say that because it might have just been I was there on a bad day. But I do love anything military, to be honest, because I do seem to have that be a magnet for that sort of stuff. Probably, actually, no, probably my favorite location at the moment, which if somebody said to me I could do every weekend for the next year, I'd probably say yes, is Langard Fort in Felixstowe.
All right, I
I
haven't heard of that.
love that place. I have converted a lot of people to that place who come saying, oh, it's big and it's got good history, but and then the stuff starts happening and they're like, I mean, to give you an example, when I was last there, it was with the Paracom guys, and we were in what would have been one of the old officers' quarters. There was myself, there was another member of their team whose name completely escapes me, Mark Williams and Wayne Seaden. And we got the door, we've got it on video, the door opening and closing on command.
Wow.
On command.
Oh
We
my
only picked it
goodness.
up doing it twice on video, but it did it about four or five times. And we checked everything, drafts. We weren't moving, so it wasn't that the wood was moving to make the door. Yeah, we got it opening and closing on command. That was pretty mind-blowing, if I'm honest. That was very exciting. Very exciting.
Oh, wow.
But I also had that I'd when I'd been there. I go, oh, my son is now. So 6 years ago, I'd one of the downstairs areas there is where the washrooms would have been, and I was sort of looking around it before the group came because I was doing the tour guide history bit for this group, and I heard someone make a kind of an exhale noise and then shuffle on the gravel inside this room, and the person I was with, he sort of screamed and ran off. Great ghost hunter. And I went in there to say, is anyone in here? Do you want to talk to me? Blah, blah, blah. Nothing else happened. So I just put it down to an experience. Anyway, took the family there for a day trip a couple of months later. And my then 4-year-old stopped outside. And obviously, I hadn't told him any of this. He stopped outside the very same room and was waving. And I said, who are you waving to, darling? And he goes, the soldier man in the corner.
Oh, that made me go all shivery. Oh my
Now,
goodness.
I went back there not so long ago, and I think we found out who the soldier man was because we put a REM pod. It's like these big steel baths, like really heavyweight, you know, the big cast iron old baths. We put a REM pod in there, and I wasn't getting much from him. And a medium who we know, she came in there and she was getting a bit. But I said, look, if you, I'm going to go now because you're obviously tired. You don't want to talk. The REM pod was screaming, like I mean screaming, until I came back. Soon as I
Wow.
came back, it stopped.
That's
I mean,
weird.
I've never heard a REM pod making sound like it. It was screaming. Now, there was, and I can't remember, quite remember the details because it's a while ago. There was a young lad, a young soldier. He was like 19, 20, 21, about that. He was from, I think he was from Liverpool way. He got shot in the head. Now, they said it was suicide, but there was no suicide note. He seemed happy. He was engaged, everything else. It made me wonder if it was suicide.
Yeah.
But I think that, but there was something else. I'm sure this kid's surname was Roberts, and we got the name Roberts come through. It was some, there was a link, and I can't quite
Yeah.
remember what it is now, to this one person. But yeah, he was screaming until I came back. Like he was having a full-on panic attack until I came back, and he said he couldn't get out of the bath. He
Oh
couldn't
my
move.
goodness.
And what was really strange is the temperature inside the bath was, it was warmer than it, it there was a temperature fluctuation that I couldn't, from a scientific perspective, explain. Because this is a heavy duty cast iron bath. There's no pipes, there's no heating.
Yeah.
It was about -2 outside. Yet inside this bath, it was getting warmer. And
Wow.
I wasn't in the bath. I was outside it. There was nobody in the bath. And the REM pod wasn't giving off that much heat.
So I wonder if something happened to him in the bath then.
He was discovered. I can't quite remember the exact details, but he was discovered shot in the head in the parade ground,
All right.
which is just outside of where
Yeah.
we would have been. But there was no indication that he was planning on doing that.
Yeah.
No war trauma, nothing. So whether I remind him of his mum, whether I remind him of his girlfriend, I don't know. But I think that might be who's come through to me on more than one
Yeah.
occasion.
Wow,
So
and
yeah,
maybe it's,
Langard
yeah.
Fort. There you go.
So you were taking an interest in him, and maybe, yeah, he felt a connection. And maybe nobody had spoken to him in all this time, and he thought, no, don't go. I
Possibly. I
need to
don't know.
talk
I
to
don't know.
him.
But honestly,
Oh,
I'd
God.
never heard a sound like it, this REM pod. Because we were in a different part of the fort, and I was like, oh, someone's REM pod's going off. And then I think it was the psychic. She came to find me and she goes, he wants you back. It won't stop. And so I went back to see if I could get it to stop. There was no one in there, no person setting it. And it's within the bath. So the bath wasn't setting it off.
Yeah.
You had to put your hand between the bath and the REM to set it.
Yeah.
And I ended up having to sort of almost like talk down a panic attack. And
Gosh.
it stopped.
That's crazy, isn't it? That
So
really
Langard
is.
Fort. There you go. Langard Fort.
Right. I have to come there. I need to
Brilliant.
put it on my list of places to go.
Brilliant. It's got it's I mean it dates the fort there's been a fortification there in some form or another since Henry VIII.
Gosh. Blimey.
And where the bang next to Felixstowe Docks. So it can get a little bit noisy for noise pollution and stuff. But Felixstowe Docks used to be a Royal Naval Air Station during World War I.
Wow.
And there is also part what that it was used also, and I can't remember if it was World War I or World War II, but it was used for laying mines, submarine mines. So it's got oh, and there's loads of other history to do with it as well. It was the site of the last ever seaborne invasion of England, where the original Royal Marine Commandos would have been based. They weren't called that then,
All
but
right, yeah.
it's got yeah, it's an amazing place just to visit as a punter, let alone
Yeah.
to investigate. But I love it there. I
Yeah.
love it.
I love places like that where I'm lucky enough to live not far from Portsmouth. And so there's lots of the old forts, castles, all sorts of stuff
Yeah.
you can visit and do investigations.
Well,
But
my
I just
most
love
recent
stuff like that.
podcast was on Fort Widley.
Oh
So,
yes. Do you
yeah.
know, I'm due to go there in a few weeks' time with a group called Paranation.
All right.
Yeah,
No,
so I'm really
I've
looking
never
forward to
been.
that.
I've never been, but it was the ironic that I recorded that podcast back in February before the new Haunted magazine came out, and then find out that Caroline McCormack has done an article on Fort Ridley, and I've got a podcast. Didn't have a clue. I have all the locations.
Oh
Just
my goodness.
so obviously Fort Ridley's calling me at some
Yeah,
point.
well, you should come. I'll tell you when I'm going. Maybe you should come over.
Oh, if you saw my calendar between now and kind of mid-June, you'd be like, no, she has got to see her kids at some point.
Oh my goodness. So, what sort of exciting things? Is there anything that you're doing that you could tell us about, or is it all top secret?
You ready for this? Right.
Yeah.
So, this coming weekend, so we're recording this on the 12th of March. This coming
Yeah.
weekend, I am heading down to Cornwall for to be one of the speakers at the Scary Southwest Conference, all female lineup of speakers, which is
Oh,
very,
nice.
very unusual. Then mid-April, I'm off to, is it Bradford upon Avon? I think it's called, near Bath, for the
Oh,
first of the
yeah.
para meets. Then the first week in May, I'm off on my kind of a holiday, but a little bit of work as well, to Canada and America with the wonderful Rachel Ashman.
Oh,
I'm going to be,
yes.
yes, going to be meeting up with Wes Coleman, who's a really good friend of mine from Canada. He's our tour guide for the week, the poor sod. And we've got a few investigations lined up for Mifflin one, and we're also going to be doing, I think it's called the Shanley Hotel in New York, which is on
Oh, yeah,
Rachel's
I've heard of that.
bucket list, which you get to stay over and everything else. And then in, so that's May, and then I can't remember when it is in June, but I know in June at some point, I think it's towards the end of June, I've got the second of the parameets, and that's just up to June.
Oh, my goodness. Well, quite
So
frankly, Penny, I
yeah.
don't think you do enough, to be honest.
Honestly, I'm compared to last year, this year is just the trajectory of this year has just gone. And so next year I'm going to have to remind my family what I look like, because I think I'm going to be doing so much work, which is amazing, and I'm very excited about all this. And I didn't see
Yeah.
this year coming. I honestly didn't. But and
Wow.
I've just
And so
filmed a
does everything just bump off each other then? Is
I
it you're
don't
doing one
know.
thing and then somebody asks you to do something else,
I
or
don't know. I don't know how
how does
it's
it happen?
working.
Tell me all
I
the
don't
magic.
know. I mean, I've just filmed another episode of Help My House Is Haunted as well.
Yeah. Love that show.
So I've got, there's one still in the can that I think's edited to come out, and there's the one that I just did last week, which is for in the new series. I don't know. I honestly don't know where it's coming from. I mean, hopefully it's that people see I do a good job,
Yeah.
and then think to either rebook, or they mention me to somebody else, or it's just like, maybe if we get her on our event, she'll shut up. I'm not
Yeah,
sure. I'm not sure, but I don't know. I don't know. I'm just doing what I've always done, and
it's working.
it's working. It's
Yeah.
starting to really work, and I think also it's because I'm still around. There's a lot of people who would have given up. I mean, I'm not doing it for all of this, if I'm completely
Yeah.
honest. I'm doing it because I enjoy it. But I
Yeah.
think there's an awful lot of people that maybe do it for a couple of years and then give
And
up.
then they fizzle out. Yeah, I've
Yeah.
noticed quite a lot of that because I'm only in my fourth year of doing my podcast. But already there have been quite a few people that were doing it at the same time as me, and they all started in lockdown like I did, and it's all kind
Yep.
of fizzled out. But I just love it. It's brilliant. So I'm interested actually. So Rachel Ashman is one of the people who organises the Festival of the Unexplained.
She is indeed.
Lovely Rachel. How long have you known Rachel? How did you get to know her?
Not that long. We met when she took over co-organizing the festival for the first one in March. So March 22. Yes, March 22. And they were supposed to do speaker interviews. And I can't remember why, but it was going to be Karen doing the interview, and she had to call off. And so Rachel was like, I've got to do it. I've never done this before. And because I'm quite used to being interviewed, I kind of tried to help out and make it as easy an interview. I do for anyone anyway, but I did sort of, because she was quite nervous. And we just chatted off air and clicked. And so, yeah, we've been really good friends, and she's one of my closest friends now. So, yeah,
Oh, that's
my
fantastic.
Yorkshire girl. Yeah, she's
Yay.
she is honestly one of the most loveliest, kindest, sweetest people I think anyone could meet.
Yeah.
She's also a lot more talented than she gives herself credit for, and her knowledge on stuff. She's what I like about her. I'm saying with people like Joan Harris and all those kind of people, is she doesn't feel the need to tell you what she knows unless you need to know the answer, if that makes sense. So, whereas I can't help myself, you know, I was out with some police officers not so long ago. I did a ride along in the back of their car, and we're driving around Chelmsford, and they weren't from Chelmsford, because they don't tend to put them where they're from. And I was showing them some history things in Chelmsford as we're driving around, and they were like, "You can't help yourself, can you?" I said, "No, you can tell me to shut up." And one of them was like, "Actually, no, I'm quite interested what you're telling us." Whereas Rach, she'll only tell you her sort of theories on things, or how she deals with something, or whatever, if you actually ask her. And I find that quite sort of interesting when she's sort of, I'm sitting there listening to someone saying, "Oh, if this was happening, I'd be doing this," rah, rah, rah. And I can see her going, and I'm thinking, I wish she would say something, but she doesn't, because she doesn't feel the need to.
Yeah.
I get overexcited. That's why I tell people facts, because I'm so excited by them. I expect everyone else to be. But Jane
I'm one
Harris
of
is,
those.
yeah, Jane Harris is like that as well. She's very much, it's only if you really push her to find information out, you realize quite how well read and well experienced, and her knowledge. But yeah, with Rachel, she is one of the loveliest people I think I've ever met. If she listens to this, she's probably going to make a sort of sicky sound, but I am very lucky to have her in my life, and I've told her that, and she thinks I'm being sarcastic. So it's on
Oh,
air. It's on air now. She
yeah.
anyone who has her in their life is a lucky person.
So there you go, Ashman. Take that and suck it. I'm really looking forward to the festival this year. I've been paying my subs every month so that I can go. And I've got my hotel room booked, and my sister-in-law's coming again. And
Okay.
it's honestly, last year when I went, it was the highlight of my year. It was literally, it was my first Paracon, and I've had a very kind of slow journey into all of this, the paranormal stuff, because I've been into it since I had some very stark experiences when I was a little girl, and I've been into it ever since. But I didn't actually realize, stupidly, I don't know why, I don't know how stupid I am sometimes, until lockdown, when I actually had time, just because I'm a teacher, my brain's going 50 miles an hour the whole time. I stopped, I sat down, and I thought, maybe I could do something like that, because I like doing things like that. And it just never occurred to me before. But so it never occurred to me to go to a paranormal convention
Well, the
until
thing
last
is, there
year.
hasn't been that many in the UK. The
Yeah.
UK is, you know, there was a few sort of little ones, but you only really had MJ Dixon's one, and then this and Parameet. So there's definitely room for more in the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, Scary Southwest, the one I'm at this coming weekend, they've sold out. And that's only
Yeah.
a one day event. They've sold out.
Yeah. Are they, I mean,
Which just shows that there is a real
there is
sort of,
a need.
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And the thing is that it was so friendly as well. I can't tell you how excited I was. The person that I was there, the person I am on the podcast, is not how I normally am. I'm actually quite shy and quiet normally, and
We
I'm
got
not.
you out of your shell.
I know. Oh no. And the thing is that I'm not very good at networking. And put me in a room full of teachers, and I will stand at the corner of the room going, "When can I leave? I just can't do this." But for some reason, I think my sister-in-law thought I was lying. I said, "Oh, I won't be able to talk to anybody. I don't know what to say. I always think I'm sounding stupid." Anyway, I got to that place and I literally just went for the whole 3 days. I was so overexcited. I talked to so many people. I met so many nice people, including yourself.
Thank
And I
you.
actually, literally, when I drove out of that drive, I cried for about 20 minutes because I felt like I'd left my family behind.
I did the first year I went, but more of it was because when you're one of the guests, like the want of a better term, celebrity guests, you are on the go from the minute you arrive to the minute you leave, and the adrenaline has to crash at some point. So one of the things I did to actually arrange this year is I could have breaks because I tend to go in like a hurricane. You can't keep that pace up. So but no, I got quite emotional with the first one in March because it was the first time I'd ever done anything like that, and I couldn't believe I'd done it. And yeah, like you say, you think it feels like a family, and it's really nice because people will do start to treat you like you're a long lost family member, and you get sort of gr new friends because of it, and new contacts because of it. And I'm finding it for the scary Southwest this weekend. I've got sort of people going, oh great, we're all going to be back together again. All the people are going that we all know, and yeah, it's a good bunch. I think that Karen and Rachel, and Nikki and Gemma too, as well, they organise such a good event, and the people who go, if you don't fit in, you won't go again. But anyone can fit in as long as they make an effort. And there's no sort of, well, you've got to be, as a woman, you've got to be a size 10, have long dark hair, whatever. There's no, it's a, it's, I always think the paranormal is a bit like a rugby team. Everyone has a place in it. Everyone has a place in it. So what I mean by that is in rugby, you can be sort of a bit short and fat and have a place. You can be one of the skinny, fast people. You've got a place. You can be something in between. You've got a place. And I always think the paranormal's like that. It's what you've, everyone has got something they can bring to it.
Yeah, definitely.
You
And I
don't
think, sorry.
need to be a certain person because nobody cares if you're covered in tattoos. Nobody cares if you don't have a single tattoo. Nobody cares. You don't, there's no particular image for people in the paranormal other than they've got an interest and they're willing to learn and they want to talk about stuff.
I think that was the great thing because I'm in a kind of quite sensible profession.
Well, so am I. I'm a financial advisor. I mean,
It's just, I found my tribe. I felt like for the first time in my life, at my age, middle age, I found my tribe and it was like, oh my God, this is amazing. It was just, and I'll come every year that I can from now on. As long as it goes, I'll be there.
I am really excited about meeting Cindy Carza this
Me
year.
too. I don't know if I'll be able to do it without going bright pink.
I think I'm the normal eloquent Penny that people are used to think she might go la, la, la,
Oh,
but
isn't it?
I am really and I have after we had Daryl's beard last year, I'm looking forward to seeing how good Shane's beard is, if it's on a par.
I might have to do some beard.
Schrader's already said he will make sure Shane lets me sort of do that, fluff his beard to see if
Maybe
it's as good as Daryl's. But I don't know if
a
he's
bit
our
of beard
Shane yet.
measuring.
Yeah, I don't know if he's asked Shane yet. So I might have to check he's asked him before I go up to it and start fondling his beard. But yeah. No sexual
So
content in
excited.
it, it's just comparing it to Daryl's.
Yes, obviously.
A beard off. A beard off.
A beard off. Maybe Mr. Schrader will make an effort and grow one.
Oh, you couldn't have a beard on. No, the same with, like with Neil
No.
Story. You can't mess with their facial hair. It wouldn't.
Yeah, wouldn't
No,
work.
no, no. There's only
No.
certain people who can carry off those beards. I mean, yeah. And you've got Dan Winter as well from Portal to the Paranormal. He's got the beard because
Yeah.
him and I know Daryl were having a beard off, and Daryl actually gave him the award for the best beard.
Oh,
So, yeah.
I'm so excited. I am so excited.
Well,
No,
I can't get excited yet. I've got too much other stuff to get through before
you
I can
have,
start bringing up the
haven't you?
excitement for that one.
I know. Well, in between my teaching, I just think if I get fed up, I think, oh, Let's just think about Festival of the X-Men for a while. Right, well, I'm going to start to wind it up now because I've kept you a very long time, but I just wanted to ask you, what's your opinion on UFOs and cryptids?
Oh my days.
Are you interested in them? Are they not really in your on your radar? Do you think it's a load of rubbish?
Cryptids, if I'm honest, I've never really looked into.
Okay.
But if they existed, I'm surprised they've not been found yet. Like definite evidence.
Yeah.
UFOs. Now, that's an interesting one. I say to people that I don't believe you can say there's definitely no life anywhere else.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because if you think every potential star up in the sky is a solar system in its own right,
Yeah.
how arrogant could we be to assume we're the only solar system that has life on it?
Yep.
Now, I do find things like Skinwalker Ranch fascinating, and I do watch that.
Yeah, I do.
I have some theories about it, which I'm hoping one of these days the professor on it will actually read my email and answer it. But do I think there's potential? Yes, I think there is. And I think if life, in whatever form it is, it may not look like us. It may be almost like a mist with a conscience. I don't know. They may have mastered how to use black holes and white holes for transportation across, like, galaxies and all that. I'm not an astrophysicist. I don't know the technical terms,
Yeah.
but they may have already mastered it by now. But I just think it's very arrogant to assume that we are the only solar system with life when every star is potentially a solar system in
Yeah.
its own right, is my thinking on it. So, do I think the royal family are alien lizards masquerading as humans? No. Do I think there's a chance that aliens walk amongst us? Yes. Do I think that some of the drawings you get in pyramids and everything else could have been of alien visitations? Yes. I think the most interesting one theory I ever read was the way, I think is it the pyramids of Giza, the way they're arranged? It's almost mimicking a solar system, which there's no way when those were constructed they could have seen those planets because you need a telescope to see them. And they could that have been some kind of alien intervention? Possibly. So no, I do think, I mean, I do think it's possible, very, very possible, and I think it's very arrogant to assume it's not.
It's not, yeah.
But what do I know much about it? Am I on a par with people like J. Austin or the Kinsella brothers or Barry Fitzgerald? Hell, not even 1%. But do I find it interesting to listen to? Yes. But I also find the UFO population is probably more antagonistic than the paranormal population at times.
Yeah.
So I kind of steer clear of
Yeah. I think it's very
Yeah.
wise.
But no, cryptids, I don't know enough about. And I think, yeah, I mean, you know, when you get them, the ones they say it's like a Yeti type character. Could that not just be a human who has that condition where they grow hair all over their bodies and they've taken to the mountains because they're sick of being teased? Could they be? I don't know. I
Yeah.
don't know. I don't know enough about them, but I do struggle to sort of But no, UFOs, I definitely believe there's life somewhere out there because I think it would be arrogant to assume there wasn't.
Yeah, I think that's a very sensible view. So I am going to wrap up now. But before I thank you profusely for coming on the
Oh,
podcast,
you're so welcome.
where can our listeners find you? Where can they come and find out about Penny?
Well, there is a website, hauntedhistories.co.uk. There's also a Facebook page, Haunted Histories, and I'm on Twitter as well. And all the links to all those can be found via my website very easily.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on and spending all this time chatting to me.
You're
It's
welcome.
been really fun. And I hope that maybe at the other end of the year, Once you've done all these exciting things, you'll come back on and tell me all about it.
Well, you might have to be sort of going, Penny, Penny, move, wake up. Because I think, I mean, that was only up to June I gave you. I've got other stuff being booked in now for the rest of the year. So it's blowing my mind, shall we say. Absolutely blowing my mind that people want to hear
Yeah.
me blather on. So yeah, as long as they want me to blather, I'll blather.
Well, I've really enjoyed listening to you blather. So,
Thank you.
Penny Griffiths Morgan, thank you very much and goodbye.
Thank you so much, Penny, for that conversation. It was really fun, and I can't wait to see Penny again when I go to the Festival of the Unexplained in September. So, people, I need you to send in your stories to me. It's still very, very quiet there on that answer machine of mine. So, let's see if we can ramp it up. I'd love to hear some of your experiences. So, don't forget to ring in and leave me a voicemail on 07935 100 162. That's 07935 100 162. Or write me an email. Or you could even send me a voicemail by email to paranormalorwhatpodcast@outlook.com. That's paranormalorwhatpodcast@outlook.com. Now, next week, I will be interviewing a guy who's written a book about Bigfoot, and his name is Mike Pudlow Umney. So I'm really looking forward to having a chat to Mike about his book. And if there are any of you who've got lots of experiences, or you're a paranormal investigator, or you've got someone you could suggest that you think I should interview, please send me either your details or the details of the person you think I should interview, and I'll get in touch with them and then we'll have them on the show. Okay, right. Well, I'm going to poddle off now because I am going to have an extremely unspooky chicken Jalfrezi made by my dear husband, and he does like to make them hot. So I think that's going to wake me up then. Then I'm going to settle down and watch something nice and spooky. So take care. Oh, I have to say as well, I've been really, really enjoying the new series of Celebrity Help My House is Haunted. And I believe that there is a new series of Help My House is Haunted coming out soon as well. So don't forget to watch it. If you've got any film or TV recommendations, let me know as well. I recently watched Exists, which is a Bigfoot film, which I thought was really good, actually. I really enjoyed it. It's one of the best ones I've seen. So have a look at that. So if there's anything you think I should be watching to do with the paranormal, then please do let me know. The more you contact me, the more I'll shout out about you and the things that you like, and we can work together and get this podcast well known. All right, well, take care, everybody, and have a fabulous week. It's been lovely to hear from you. And don't forget, get your tot of something hot and spicy, settle down, and recommend the podcast to everybody else. Don't forget to rate and review the show. I really need those rates and reviews. Thank you so much for listening. Take care, everybody, and I'll see you next week. Night.